Hey Joe, I like your show. I tell everybody that's my shit. And if you got a long ride and you like getting high, maybe go and take another hit. We gonna laugh out loud, that's what it's about. Nobody ain't safe no more. And Joe stands out even in a big crowd, cause a motherfucker 6'4". Hey Joe, it's time to start the show. Up, up and away we go. Mic check and I like your flow. Everybody, here's Joe.
All right, everybody, welcome to another episode of the Joe Prano Podcast. I am very excited for this week's episode. My guest today, a friend of mine for a few years now, a fantastic comedian and actor who used to have a great show out in Highland Park that I would do from time to time. And he is now a first-time novelist. He sent me his fantastic golfing murder mystery, The Big Snooze, in the mail. The Big Snooze, a Duffer McDermott mystery. I received it in the mail. I read it. I loved it. And I immediately reached out to him to talk about it on the show. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome Cornelius Peter.
Oh, well, thanks for having me, Joe. I'm really glad that you liked the book. You read it so quickly.
I really did. I loved it. I have, you know, we're in this business where at some point everybody tries to write something.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Quote unquote legitimate.
Exactly. And I, you know, sometimes when your friends go, hey, I wrote something, will you read it? You come in with pretty low expectations. I came into this with higher expectations because I always found you to be quite hilarious. I also found your stand-up writing to always be very smart. So I was like, I'm excited. This should be good. And I got to say, my expectations were not high enough. I was blown away by how much I enjoyed it and how quickly I read it. I think I'll probably end up reading it again.
Well, thank you. You know what? You don't have to read it again. Book number two is coming along next year. So I got plenty more in the pipeline for you to enjoy. But I'm so glad that you loved it. And I'm so glad to hear that you read it quickly. This is something that I keep hearing from people. And I've been hearing it ever since I finished the book and sort of handed out to a couple of friends just to pre-read it. That's sort of the first part of the whole process. It's like, okay, I've written it. Now I'm going to give it to two people to read, and they got to be people that I trust and who are going to be nice to me if it's a piece of shit. So, you know, I gave it to my girlfriend and she loved it, but that doesn't count. Right.
Right.
And I gave it to a friend of mine who is an actual published novelist. She writes murder mysteries. She's a great writer. She's actually had, I think she had a couple of bestsellers a few years ago or whatever. But anyway, I sent it to her and she read it in one night. And she was like, wow, this is great. And when she said that, and she said she had read it in one night, that's when I knew I had something. And I've heard that from a number of people along the way. They sit down, it catches their attention, and then they just blow right through it, which is that's the biggest compliment as a writer. For me, anyway, that's the biggest compliment I could have gotten because I sat down to write a page turner, as they call it. So hopefully it's that.
I think I read it in three sittings. I, you know, started to read it knowing that I didn't have the time to sit there. I was like, oh, let me just get a taste for it. I think I read a couple of chapters and was like, oh, I can't wait to sit down and read that again. And then the next day, I think in two separate sittings, I finished the thing off and was so fun. So, you know, such an easy breezy read. Now, tell me how this came about. Because before the show, we were talking sort of what our pandemics were like. Was this a pandemic, right? Or something you've been planning for a while?
Now, strangely enough, it was not a pandemic, right? I kind of wish it was. I spent the pandemic writing book two. So I'm still writing the second book. This is the first book in a series. I'm planning to do at least three of these books in the Duffer McDermott series. starring the same gumshoe, if you will, gumshoe in golf shoes. He's a, you know, he's a golfer, but he's also a detective who solves mysteries. So I'm going to do at least three of these books. Now, I was very cocky at the beginning, and I believe I said to my girlfriend that I was going to write 18 of these books. Now, I said that before I had ever even finished the first one. So I'm not really necessarily sure I'm going to commit to 18 of these things, but I am going to do three of these. So I started writing it probably about a year before the pandemic started. And then I spent most of the pandemic sending it to people to read and then changing it based on their suggestions. I mean, this is, it's certainly not, I wouldn't call it a group effort. I'm taking most of the credit. But I do send, when I send it to people, you know, if they say, look, that didn't work, or what about this, or there was a plot hole somewhere. So there was a lot of that back and forth. And so I spent the pandemic just waiting for the editor to be done, you know, and then it got to the professionals, editors, the cover design, all that kind of stuff. Right. So all of that was going on during the pandemic, and then finally came out last month. It's been a labor of love for sure.
Now, we were talking about my newfound love of golf. And yeah. So immediately I was like, great. I'm already reading 10 books in golf simultaneously.
Yeah.
As one does when they first pick up the game. So it was easy for me to be like, yeah, let's read some stuff about golf. Are you a golfer? Is this something that comes from your own history?
The funny thing is, I am not a golfer. I love the game. Let me put it this way. I love watching the professional game. So I watch the PGA all the time and I follow that. I wouldn't say religiously, but that's probably the main sport that I watch. So I love watching the PGA, and I always have. And I've certainly played golf a bunch of times during my life, but it's never been a passion of mine. It's not something that I've spent a lot of time doing. Now, the idea for the book came to me on the driving range. So there definitely is the direct connection there. And that's what I love to do in golf, is I love the driving range. Like, I can go hit a bucket of balls and I'm good. Yeah. That's fine. Like, to me, 18 holes seems like so long. It's such a commitment. It's like 4 hours. My God. Like, do you enjoy that part of it? Do you enjoy going out and being gone for 4 or 5 hours? And it's a whole day.
I was the same way as you in my life. Growing up, I never golfed. I never, like, it was just not something I got into. Just, it wasn't something that, like, you know, my dad did or whatever. And I remember at some point along the way, somebody gifted him a nice set of clubs, and I would just take him to the driving range and just whack balls. And then the first few times I got asked recently to join somebody for a round, I found myself, you know, 6 or 7 holes in being like, oh my God, I can't believe it's already almost halfway over. And I'm like,
really
enjoying it. Like when you're in a good movie and you don't want it to end. And I was like, oh, I think I'm going to be your stereotypical 40 something white dude and just do this 3 times a week now.
Yeah, I know. And I think a lot of people like us sort of resist it because it seems like such a conservative, like, guy with a regular job and 2 kids kind of sport. So it feels like it should be boring, but it's actually just the sport itself is fun as heck. And so what's keeping me from playing more, because I'm interested in learning to play more and doing more than just the driving range, but I'm at that stage where I am terrible. And the only people I know who play golf are pretty good. Yeah. So do you feel any hesitation going out and being the weak link in that foursome? Like, you're going to be the guy who holds them up? Or have you ever had a problem with that?
I mean, at first that was the fear, being like sort of embarrassed and being the guy who always is always chasing your ball. And somebody gave me a pretty good piece of advice early, and they were like, listen, when you're playing with people who are better than you, all that's important is if you suck quickly.
Yeah. Right.
Okay. Don't slow us down. You know, don't look for your ball for 10 minutes. You know, be prepared to drop one, hit a new one. And so then I just kind of kept that going. And at first I was sucking, but sucking quickly. And then, you know, you start to figure it out. The great thing about golf is that, you know, if you birdie a hole, you're like, you're like, wow, that's about as good as anybody ever does here.
You know? Yeah, right.
So it's like you suddenly feel like, I'm not going to just go out for a casual day of basketball and dunk on someone in traffic. You know,
right.
Like it's, but in golf, you have those moments and then you're like, I just need to, you know, get 18 of them in a row.
Yeah, right. I got a birdie and Jack Nicklaus got a birdie and Tiger Woods got a birdie. We all got birdies. So on this hole, we're all the same.
Yeah. There's a, I believe it's at Rancho Park here in LA. There's a plaque on one of the holes that says Jack Nicklaus shot a 12 here during the LA Open. And I'm always like, well, as long as I have 11 or better.
Yeah, right. I did a little bit. Yeah, exactly. We have to have those inspirational things around the turn.
I was when I was reading the book, because I didn't know the answer to that question, I was I was trying to determine if you were like a lifelong golfer, if you were not.
And, guessed.
And I would have guessed that, yeah, you were like at least a, you know, casual lifelong guy, because you have, there was, as a guy who's like immersed in it right now.
Yeah, right.
I didn't catch anything or any, you know,
one
little thing here. The only, honestly, the only thing I caught is on the fantastically magical, I think it's hole. There's you know, an island green that you have to walk out to. It's like, and you get free water drops back on the tee. But other than that, but that's also a very mystical sort of magical hole in the book.
And it's supposed to be a little bit beyond what is absolutely possible in the game of golf. That's on purpose, because I got that note. Remember, I was saying I sent the book around to, and one of the things I made sure to send it was to a bunch of people who play golf. Now, my brother is a lifelong golfer, obsessed with golf. So is my uncle. So are a couple people, a bunch of people I know, actually. So I sent it to them. And the only note I got on the golf consistently throughout was that they would just never have a hole that difficult.
Yeah.
There would be, it's a little fantastical. But again, I knew that going in, and I just left it like that because I just thought it was fun. Like, it's supposed to, you know, everything in the book is exaggerated just a little bit, like it
Absolutely.
Would be in a comedy, right? You know, it's Caddyshack, basically. You know, it's that level. I wanted the golf to ring true, because I knew that golfers were going to read this, and golfers are very fanatical, very precise, very into it. They know if I made a mistake or too many mistakes, I knew I was going to hear about it from the golfers. So I was very careful to try to make sure that it really read true, and that there weren't any real just glaring errors like that. And I'm glad to hear that so far. I'm sure people nitpick these things to death, and I'm waiting for it. But we'll find the stuff.
Well, not me. So, I mean, you know, I'm only a year and a half in, but like I said, it's pretty much an obsession right now. And I was like, no, he seems like he is a true dimplehead, as you call them in the book.
Yeah, a dimplehead. Right. Exactly. Well, I did a ton of research. I mean, I didn't just sort of guess at it. Right. So, like I said, I already watched the PGA. So I watched and I paid attention and took notes and all that kind of stuff. And then when I would imagine the golf in my head, I would imagine them playing the holes and I would write it out. Then I would go back and look, okay, so what's wrong here or what's right here? Is the yardage good? And that's the hardest part of this book to write for me, for sure, was the golf. The mystery part, which is very complicated, is also difficult, but not as hard as the golf.
You know, you said you did the research, and I'm reading the book, and you mention, you know, his great grandfather or whatever being the guy who won
and
the US Open. And I'm reading, and I was like, let's Wikipedia that and see if that's true.
Yeah.
And I was impressed, and I'm like, you know, there's really a lot of thought. So now, what comes first? Do you end up naming him Duffer McDermott after doing the research on the golfer?
Well, I'm so glad that you brought that up. That is actually a total coincidence. So the name McDermott is my mother's maiden name. So his name was Duffer McDermott from the first day I was writing this book. And then during the research, I was just Googling around. Somewhere I came across John McDermott. And he was a real champion. One of the first U.S. He was one of the first native born player to win the U.S. Open. And I just thought, well, how fun would it be to make my character just a descendant of his. And he had a really interesting backstory too, because basically, I don't know, I can't say definitively that the game drove him insane, but he did suffer a nervous breakdown at some point in his life. As a golfer, and he never really took the sport up again. So I also thought, just because of that, it's sort of a neat metaphor, because people do like to say that it is a kind of game, it can drive you insane. I mean,
absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, do you find it a frustrating game? You seem to take it with some ease.
Oh no, I'm the complete opposite. I'm doing it casually, but when I'm in the thick of it, I mean, yeah. Behind me over here is my 3-iron that I snapped when I threw it probably 40 yards off a tree. It's one of those things. I always said that I would start golfing when I got old, and yeah. I broke my knee in January of 2020. And in the recovery, I was like, well, I can't really surf right now or play volleyball or do any of the things I wanted. It seems like I got old in one day. I should do this golf thing. And, you know, being an athlete obviously helps, but it's so frustrating because naturally in my life, if I played basketball for a year and a half, I would suddenly be better. And yet you go out on the golf course and you'll have days where you're like, I am worse than when I didn't know how to hold a golf club. It is the most painfully frustrating sport I've ever participated in.
But don't you feel that there's a parallel to stand up like that? Like, cause you can be doing stand up forever and you think you have that night and you're like, every joke killed. I got it down. Now from here on, I'm just cruising. And you go out and the next night you will eat shit and you will be like, why am I doing this?
Absolutely.
But you still have to go back and get better. That's the thing that drives you. And that's sort of when I was writing about how Duffer feels about the game of golf, his ambition to be great for one, and also his dedication and his training to just, no matter how many times this guy loses a tournament or doesn't win a tournament, rather, because he's obviously a good golfer, but he always goes back for more. All I had to do was tap into my love of stand-up to sort of transpose that to the game of golf. And so the way Duffer feels about golf, which is he can never give it up, even though it's torturous, and it encompasses all of his hopes and dreams. You know, if it all goes right, it could just be the thing that saves his life and everything will be joyous, but he never quite gets there. I don't feel that way about golf, but I definitely feel that way about comedy. So I just sort of swapped in one for the other, and I found that I wrote it quite easily when it came to the emotions and the way he feels about the game of golf and what it does to you too. You know, it's a performance, really. You know, I mean, that's the thing that amazes me about the PGA Tour, beyond just the difficulty of the game of golf. So you understand the difficulty of the game of golf just when you're playing with your buddies and no one's watching. Could you imagine playing that with, you know, 50,000 people standing there watching you and another million or so at home? Like, the amount of nerves that these guys have to suppress just to drive the ball off tee number one is always just fascinating to me. And I think for them too, it's the same every time. It never gets easy. I can't imagine easy.
Yeah. And that's what's awesome about the book as well, is this guy is a lifelong golfer, but the entire mystery unfolds while he's playing in his first PGA event.
Yes, it's his big shot, and not only does he have to try to win a PGA tournament, which would get him his PGA Tour card and change his life. I mean, again, it's always, you're only one tournament away from changing your whole life, just like your one Tonight Show appearance from changing your whole life. So Duffer McDermott can change his whole life if he just wins this golf tournament. Unfortunately, somebody gets murdered. The head of the country club gets murdered on night one, and he's a prime suspect. So he now has to solve the murder while playing the tournament of his life. It's a lot to do in 4 days.
Yeah. And that was what I love too. The book sort of just opens without a kind of title section, and then this is the night before the tournament starts. What I love, especially as somebody who's watching more and more golf, is then you have the sort of chapter-ish or less, you know, section breaks, which Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and you're like, this is all happening while a golf t- tournament goes on, it puts you right back into that. Okay, he's on cut day right now. This is important to the story as well.
Yeah, exactly. Well, each day of a golf tournament has a different feel to it, right? Yeah. You know, I mean, Friday's a huge day because if you don't, you know, make the cut, then you're just going home. So that's the first. And then Saturday, well, moving day, right? If you got to move up and be in position for Sunday. And then, of course, Sunday is Sunday. That's where it all comes down. So it really lent itself to the structure of sort of a fast paced murder mystery, I thought. And the other thing that's lovely is, even though I was just saying golf takes so long, 4 hours, but still, if you've got a detective who needs to solve a murder and he's got a lot of people to interview and he's got a lot of things to do and other things need to happen, the fact that golf only takes 4 hours leaves me 20 hours with which my characters can do other stuff. So it breaks it up very nicely.
Now you mentioned Caddyshack before, and in reading it, the thing that jumped out at me is like the name that kept coming back was Fletch. It has a very, it has a very Fletch vibe. Sure. And I was like, and Fletch obviously played famously by Chevy Chase in Caddyshack in the golf world. Like, have you gotten that feedback? Like
And yeah, again, I take it as a compliment, and I also wear it on, I wear my influences on my sleeve, for sure. But I mean, the Fletch books, I don't know if you've ever read the Fletch books.
I haven't.
By Gregory MacDonald, they're amazing. They're fantastic. There's Fletch, Return of Fletch, and Son of Fletch, I think, at least. But they're definitely a big influence on this book. But obviously, that's also one of my favorite movies. And then you have Chevy Chase both in Caddyshack and Fletch. I mean, if I wrote this book 20 years ago, I certainly would be angling to try to get Chevy Chase to play Duffer McDermott. So when that inevitably happens, I don't know who the today's equivalent of Chevy Chase would be, but he's certainly in my head as far as, you know, when I'm writing this, that it's just that tone and that vibe and that whole sort of carefree attitude, right? It's one of the things I love about Caddyshack is that when you watch that movie, and I've watched that movie, I don't know how many times, I mean, a bazillion times, if that's a number. But you feel like, I always feel like, God, I wish I lived there. God, I wish that was my life. Their cares are so minimal. There's nothing. They're just, you know, idle rich, playing golf or whatever. And I love that feel, because I think even if you've never lived that lifestyle, you can enjoy watching people in that sort of milieu. And so I wanted to create that when I wrote this book. And that's how I came up with the town, the fictional town of La Siesta, California, aka the Big Snooze, which is what the book is called. But I wanted one of those places where, boy, wouldn't it be nice to live there?
And it's exactly the feeling you get. I was, and in reading it, I'm like, I just want to go play this golf course.
Yeah, the way it's described. Bloody Mary, right?
There's a nature preserve right next door. It's cliffside. It's like, you know, you almost describe like a Southern California Pebble Beach vibe. And I was like, oh, this is, I just want to go play this course.
Exactly. And that's really what it is. It's sort of a combination of Torrey Pines and Pebble Beach. And certainly the hole we were talking about before, the notorious 13th hole, is just like a ridiculous version of the 7th at Pebble Beach. Is it the 7th at Pebble Beach?
Yeah.
Which is the tiny little green just sitting out there. But yeah, it's a combination of all those great things. And that's the wonderful thing about choosing to do a fictional town, is that you can take all the great attributes of all the great courses of the world and sort of swap them into whatever it is that I'm writing, rather than be, you know, confined to what's happening in, you know, Carmel, California, or Pines, or whatever. That being said, for future iterations of this story, future books, I plan to take Duffer, and eventually he's probably going to make it to the PGA Tour, and play some of these great courses. And I think that's another thing that I look forward to. I'd love to have him go to the Masters and set one there, and have him go to Pebble Beach, set one there, have him go to Scotland, you set one there. You know, you could take him to Japan. You can take him anywhere as long as there's a golf course.
Yeah. Well, I think it's fantastic. Now, I've read a few mysteries in my life. I'm not like a murder mystery head, you know, but I've never spoken to somebody who's written one. So immediately when I knew we were going to talk, it's how do you lay out the actual mystery? We're not going to give away who done it, but
no spoilers.
How do you decide how this is all going to like play out, and how early on did you know, okay, this is how it goes?
Well, that's a great question. And you'll be surprised that the answer is that I don't know how it's going to end when I start. And this was my first murder mystery, so I don't know if I'm doing it right. But how I did it this time was I knew I had the hero. Okay. So I knew it was a golfer and I knew it was going to be set at a golf tournament. So I just started writing it. And then once I had enough characters, I figured out which character it was going to be. That's to say, who was the murderer. But before I could decide who was the murderer, I had to create the characters, right? You can't pin on anybody until you've got a bunch of people to pin it on. So what I did was created about 8 or 10 characters. And at some point, I think it was probably about 2 or 3 weeks into writing it, I knew who did it. And it just came to me in a flash. And I was like, oh, that's perfect. Okay, great. Now I know who did it. And then from there, I just had to make the mystery work, which is difficult, especially when you don't really know what you're doing. But I just kept writing until I figured it out. And what I would say is there's no real magic to it, but there's a lot of editing. So I write about 120,000 words and then cut it down to what you get, which is about 80,000. So there's a whole bunch of great stuff that I write that I have to throw away because it doesn't work for the murder. And that's what happens when you don't know how the murder works until the end. So again, I don't know if this is the right way to do it or not. I wish Agatha Christie was here. We could dig her up and be like, so how did you do it? I'm sure there's probably a more efficient way of doing it, but that's how I did it this time. And it seemed to work for me. But I basically, I just kept going until it occurred to me. And then I just did whatever I could to make it work. But it's, the whole thing's a bit of a mystery. I mean, it's taking a big flyer when you start something like this, because there's a very good chance that you get to the end and it doesn't work. And that's where the other people come in. That's when you send it to people and you say, does this work? Did I fool you? And I am a big mystery head, so that helps too. I mean, I've been reading Agatha Christie since I was probably 10 years old. And all sorts of other mysteries too. So I wouldn't say that when I was reading those books going along, because I always wanted to write a book, but I didn't know that it would be a murder mystery necessarily. But so I think over the years I've absorbed how they are written. And so when it came time for me to do it, I had some idea what it should look like, how it should work, sort of like a person who grew up listening to the Rolling Stones. And then at a certain age, somebody puts a guitar in your hand and you're like, well, I know what it sounds like. So at least I have that going for me. But otherwise it was a lot of just feeling it out and hoping that it would work, and then being very pleased when it did.
Well, I think, you know, with every great murder mystery, along the way, when you're introduced to somebody and you get some information about them, you go, well, this is it. This is the person. And then you meet somebody else and you go, well, now this is it. And then you start reading or watching enough of them, you go, well, this is just what they do. They're going to give me 10 people I think are going to do it. And then none of them are going to be it, or one of them. And it's, you know, it's not going to be the one I had settled on.
Right. Yeah.
Why I said I want to read it again is because, you know, the whodunit did catch me by surprise. And I was like, oh, I love that. And I didn't see that coming. Now I wonder if I go back knowing, will I pick up things that I missed?
Yeah. And that is exactly what's so fun about a good murder mystery. A murder mystery that works is you can't just pin the murder on somebody who walked across the stage in Act One and we don't know who it is. You know what I mean? It has to be a satisfying conclusion. And the way that it's satisfying for people is that you can do exactly what you're talking about. You look back and you go back and look at the clues. Oh, that's why this happened and that's why that happened and that's what this happened or whatever. And when it works like that, it's fantastic. It just gives you that feeling of like, oh, it was there in front of me the whole time. It's very much like a card trick. And you have to make it really fun for the people. And that it was, but it's fun for me too. I mean, if it's fun for you to have that happen, could you imagine how fun it is for me when I realized I had done that? I was like, right. Oh yes, I know how to do this. It's really fun, but yeah, you make everyone a suspect. And then it's usually, I mean, as the cliche goes, it's usually the person you least suspect or whatever, but you have to give them the clue. You have to give the readers the clues that lead to the eventual suspect, or else it won't. You can't just, you know, confuse everyone for 250 pages and be like, surprise, it was the butler, because right. Then everybody, oh, that's very lame. No, it has to all be there. And that's where the editing and the rewriting and, you know, writing all that extra stuff that I end up throwing away is because everything has to point to the murderer and it all has to be satisfying. But yeah, it's a great feeling. And it's one of the great things I love about murder mysteries is when it all comes together like that.
And I did get a sense of satisfaction from it. And it's like, you know, sometimes the story itself and everything that you're given is so great and you follow along. Like I remember watching Mystic River. I never read the book, but you're like, oh, it's so well acted and it's so intense. And like all this happens and you're like, it was the kid who left a voicemail in the beginning. Did we even see him again? Like,
I hate
this fucking movie now.
Yeah. Right. No, I know. Hey, listen, on a different note, I got the leaf blower guys just showed up at my house. Can you hear any of that?
Cannot hear that.
So okay,
you're good.
LA. Okay, good.
Yeah.
But yeah, well, actually, I generally love Dennis Lehane's novels, which I think that one's based on. But it's a difficult thing to do for anybody.
And I'm sure the book does a way better job than the Hollywood adaptation.
That's the funny thing about Hollywood too, is like, they don't care about stuff like that. They're like, oh no, nobody cares. Like, no, but we do care. I bet, especially mystery. I mean, that's the other thing. And writing this book, I had two, well, naturally three very rabid fan bases that I have to try to cater to without screwing up. So I have golfers who are going to call me out on anything wrong about the golf, right? And then I have mystery heads who, if I don't do the mystery right, they'll take me to task on that. And then I've got deadheads. So, right, if I, with Grateful Ted in there, if I don't get the Grateful Dead stuff right, or if any of that is not, because they're all going to be all over me as well. No, wait a minute, that happened 1971, not 1972. Yeah. Whatever it is, like, I really set myself a difficult task to please all these people. So far, so good. But, you know, the internet's a big place. I'm sure I'm going to find some nitpickers out there.
Now, was because you talked about three truly rabid fan bases. Is that something that you go, well, if I get a little of these folks and a little of these folks, that's a pretty big audience. If I can get a few deadheads, was that something that was thought about in advance?
Not in advance, but very shortly after the book came together, I definitely thought this is not bad for marketing purposes. I know who my audience is. You know what I mean? And a lot of writers would be very happy to have that kind of easily pinpointed. You know, I know that golfers are going to pick it up. I know that, you know, and mystery readers are great. Mystery readers will stay with you forever if you write a good book. But deadheads too. And that all came very naturally, the story itself. So the reason we're talking about the Grateful Dead, I guess we should tell the peoples, but there's a, so the cat, my book is about a golfer and his caddy is a character named Grateful Ted. And he's sort of one of the best
characters in the whole book, for sure.
Yeah, he's a deadhead, of course, and he has a special talent where he's sort of a savant, a Grateful Dead savant when it comes to the history of the Grateful Dead. And his special trick is that he can name the set list from any Grateful Dead concert in history. So for those unfamiliar with the Grateful Dead, I'm sure you know, played a zillion concerts during their lifetime. And every night they played different songs in different orders out of a, you know, a catalog of about 350 songs. They would play 20 or so a night, and they always played a different show every night. So Grateful Ted, if you name any date that the Grateful Dead had a concert, he can tell you what they played in the order they played it off the top of his head. So he's sort of a cross between sort of like Rain Man and Bagger Vance, if you will, right? Because he's out of his, tree. He's absolutely crazy, but he's also the greatest caddy that Duffer McDermott has ever had. And he's like, he's just a golf whisperer, right? He knows what the wind is going to do. He knows what the course is like. He knows how, which club to hit, when to hit it, and how to hit it.
And like so many old hippies, he's just sort of going on his vibes, you know, he's just feeling the vibe.
Yes, it's all very zen and very, you know, tie-dye sort of new age hippy-dippy. But so that aspect of the book and that all works into the murder. The history of the Grateful Dead somehow gets folded into the murder mystery itself. And that's another aspect of my life that sort of worked its way in here. I've been a Deadhead since I was about 12 or 13. And when the character Grateful Ted jumped into my head, that was sort of one of those moments early on where I was like, I think this book could actually get finished. I think I might actually have something here because, you know, having a good character and having a good setup is one thing. But then when you start populating it with funny, kooky people and they make you laugh like Grateful Ted does, that's when I sort of was like, yeah, I think people are going to like this. So, yeah, I've been marketing it to the Deadheads and the golfers and the mystery people. And so far, so good. People, the response has been fantastic. I mean, very similar to your response, which was people are reading it really quickly and getting back in touch with me like, wow, this is really cool. And I loved how you did this. And I loved how you did that. And the Deadheads seem to love Grateful Ted and the golfers seem to love the golf. So it's all making very happy.
And I think most importantly, the thing that sort of isn't, you know, sort of on the forefront or isn't like also this aspect of it, but I knew I would have going in is it's hilarious. It's really funny.
Thank you.
I mean, yeah. even the, you know, the subtle choices like Duffer sort of in bad with some mobsters and in every version of everything, the mobsters are they're Italian first or then they're Eastern European, and if they're right. not and if then if somebody goes off the beaten path, they're, you know, British or Irish. You have right. Canadian mobsters.
The Raquette brothers. Oh yes, the Canadian mobsters. They cornered the maple syrup market and screwed everybody and had to leave Canada. Yeah, they were so fun to write. And again, it was just one of those things when those guys came on the scene, I was like, well, this is fun. And they're, you know, and mobsters are, you know, great in a crime story, right? You got to love that. But also, how many times have we seen Italian gangsters? How many times exactly. have we seen Italian mobsters? And really, I mean, there are Canadian mobsters there. I mean, again, that was from research. That was there was Canadian, and there have been maple syrup scams. There have been huge maple syrup like tariff scams and stuff like that pulled off by organized crime. It's not all in Little Italy. So, yeah, I mean, coming up with stuff like that, I mean, part of getting through something so long is this, you know what I mean? I mean, it's not that long. To read the book, it takes 3 days. To write the book, it takes 9 months, right? So it's a long time to be sitting at your desk, and it's a real pleasure when it makes you laugh, when it makes me laugh. You know what I mean? It's like, I'm hoping to make you laugh. But if it can make me laugh, that helps me get through it. You know what I mean? It's pleasurable to write stuff like this when it genuinely makes you just kind of chuckle like, boy, this is, and it's, you know, the book veers into silly a little bit, just beyond what, you know, happens in the real world, I would say. I always try to keep the tone just a one click above normal, maybe right. something. But yeah, and I don't think that there are a ton, with the exception of the Fletch books, which are very funny. And there's very often humor in murder mysteries. But I wouldn't say that there are a lot of murder mysteries like this, like the one that I wrote, The Big Snooze, where there's a real emphasis on trying to, on being funny, on having the book be funny. But what I found was that actually humor is a great way to distract people when you're laying down clues. And I hope that doesn't say too much about it when you're reading with the next person reading the book who's listened to this. But humor is a great distraction. Just a, like I said, the whole thing's a bit of a magic trick. Yeah. It's kind of like, don't look over here, look over here. Don't look over here, look over here, because you're laying down all these clues that you will then go back and, you know, pick up at the end. But humor is great for that. Throwing a joke in there, if everybody's laughing at the joke, they don't notice that you slipped the knife under the pillow or whatever it is you did. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. It's really, really funny. And, you know, I know you said in going through the mystery, you go back and you can kind of reseed the, you know, yeah, the green with your clues. Did you do that with did you do that with the comedy as well? Because obviously when we write stand-up, it's always taking your premise. You go out there, you do some jokes, and you're like, oh, I can go back and punch this up. How much of the comedy was in there through the first pass versus, oh, I'm going to go and punch it more?
Well, I mean, I think that's a lot of the stuff that ends up on the cutting room floor is because it's funny, but it doesn't do anything to advance the plot or whatever, right? Writing funny, I mean, writing funny is hard, don't get me wrong, but writing funny is easier when it's not, doesn't have to deliver information, doesn't have to move the story forward in particular ways. And so I'd come up with funny things, and but I'd be like, yeah, but it doesn't get Duffer to the next destination that I need him to go to, or it's a funny story, but it doesn't have anything to do with the mystery. So there's a lot of that. But at the same time, I still think there's value for me to write those things, even if they end up on the cutting room floor, because it keeps the general sort of atmosphere of comedy going. And then I'm left with very little of what I started with, but it's just enough to keep it going. But yeah, it's just a lot of punching up, a lot of rewriting. And it's tough because you don't have an audience to tell you. I mean, that's the one thing that's weird about writing a book, especially as a comedian. When you do comedy, you go out, you tell a joke, the audience either laughs or doesn't. You get your feedback right there. You write a book, it takes you a year to write the book. And then it takes 6 months for the first person to finish reading it. You're like, Jesus, is that joke funny or not?
Yeah. Well, that kind of leads into my next question, because when I pick up the book, just looking at the cover, it's The Big Snooze, a Duffer McDermott mystery. So I was like, okay, this is the first of something. And then, you know, you get to the end and you... In the first book, you have a sort of a preview to what's going to come. Yeah. Duffer McDermott returns in A Hole in Two. How early on in the process did you know that you wanted to make it, you know, a series? And then also, was there ever a moment where you're sitting there going like, well, first I need to see if anybody likes this or else I'm going to have a preview for a book that never comes out?
Yeah, I know. Well, there's a lot. Yeah. So to answer your first question, like I said, I was very enthusiastic very early on, probably over enthusiastic. So I went full, the needle went full tilt, and I was like, honey, I'm going to write 18 of these. Like I was very inspired, and I still am, and I think we all should be, by Sue Grafton. Are you familiar with the author Sue Grafton? She wrote, The ABC mystery. So her premise was she was going to write 26 books with the same protagonist. So A is for alibi, B is for burglar, C is for whatever. And I've always loved that idea, the audacity of walking into a publisher's office and being like, one book. Oh no, I'm going to do 26 books. Like, you got to love the woman. Like, Jesus Christ. She just had.
Yeah. And the publisher being like, we'll commit till D is for death. But after that, you know, we'll see.
Yeah, exactly. But it's just, it takes chutzpah, I think is the word, to walk in there or whatever. And so I was sort of inspired by that. I was like, well, there's 18 holes on a golf course. Boy, I'd like to do 18 books, and I'm going to do a short story between every book. So every 9 books, we're going to get a book of short stories. Well, I don't know if I will ever do that, although I still think that that is possible. I'm not going to say that that's not possible. I would like to do that. But I immediately wanted it to be a series. And again, I'm a mystery reader. So I like series myself. I love I love discovering an author who I've never read before, who has 10 books and I can just go back and read their back catalog. I love discovering a band that I've never heard before. And like, oh my God, these guys have 8 albums, or this person has 10 albums or whatever. And so I always envisioned it as a series starring Duffer McDermott and taking place largely in La Siesta, California. Although, like I said, he's going to move around a little bit. But I would say at the very least, I'm going to do 3 of these. And I've already got a short story done that I'm going to put those out sort of in between the books just for fun, as just like Kindle singles and stuff like that. But to your point, like, I'm already worried that the title of my second book may have to get changed, because I'm like, wow, I really made, because I changed the title. It was not called The Big Snooze for a long time. The first title was Fast Green, which is sort of a theme in the book. And I thought it was kind of a neat metaphor for trying to get money quickly, which is something that happens in the book. He needs money. But so I changed the title of that book halfway through. So I don't know. I was very, very nervous to do that. But I also, you only get one shot at publishing your first book. And I know that the second book is definitely going to come out. I guess it's going to be called A Hole in Two, because I think I'm locked into that now, but it totally makes me nervous. And I hope I don't regret it. I mean, I've written enough of book two that I feel pretty confident that I think that's going to be good. And I will tell you this, book two is definitely coming out, but there's a slight chance it might have a different title.
That's hilarious. Well, it's great. And like an old Grateful Dead rarity or something like that. You're like, I have a version of it where he's got the hole in two in the back still before changed to what it became.
Yeah, exactly. I was thinking it would be fun to do. I could do a version of this book as an NFT, but just change the ending. Right? Yeah. The only the person who buys the NFT gets the alternate ending where it was actually, you know, a suicide or whatever. I don't know.
I mean, the great thing about the book in terms of thinking about it as a series, and obviously you said you always knew it wanted to be around Duffer's. Duffer's just such a great character.
Oh, that's great to hear.
And so you want to read more. You're like, yes, what is he going to get up to next? You know?
Yeah.
Are there elements of this book that you had thought about laying anything down for, like, I'm setting this up, this is going to happen in book two or book three? Or are there things that are you that thought out where you're like planning for the next ones?
Yes and no. I mean, there are things that have happened sort of organically that will show up again, that have already showed up again in book two. I mean, there are things that I plan on showing up again over and over again, like the town and, you know, the main character, and a couple of the secondary characters. But yes, there are. And some of that is by design, and some of that is happy accident, sort of like the John J. McDermott, you know, discovering the golfer in the past who actually really existed. Sometimes when you start something like this, it's really neat how the universe just sort of sprinkles things in there. And I'm like, oh, wow, look, I didn't mean for that to be something that's going to carry through. But I can see now that I'm writing book two, how useful it is that I have this in place, or I have that in place, or whatever. I've sort of created this whole world. And when I step back into it, sometimes I'm even surprised to find, like, oh yeah, that's right. I forget he drives this kind of car, or he does this kind of thing, and it works, and it actually fits perfectly into what I'm trying to do in book two. And I don't know how that stuff happens. I think if you just work hard enough, the universe every once in a while will just throw you a bone.
Well, I'm excited. I truly am. I loved it. I'm you know, right. No pressure, but the sooner we can get a hole in two out, the better. I'll read this again in the meantime. Can you give us, is there anything that you can give us from going forward for the people who read, who hear this and then read it? Anything that you can give them for things that we might look out for in future Duffer McDermott mysteries?
Well, I would say that, there's a short story coming out, and it's going to come out in the spring. And that's based on he plays a high stakes skins game with some ridiculous kind of billionaire guys. And then in book two, there is the return. The Raquette brothers are, and you'll know this if you read the book, but the Canadian mobsters are locked up But that doesn't stop Duffer from getting involved with them. And he ends up, I don't want to give it away, but he ends up back in trouble with the Raquette brothers, let's just say.
They'll be his arch nemesis for a long time, sounds like.
Yeah, I mean, there's a few things that will keep recurring. Some of those things will pop up.
Well, thank you for taking the time to talk about it. I really hope that the listeners of this show can go out and get a copy and read it and enjoy it as much as I do. For somebody who's just published their first novel, it must be interesting to see where it's going and who's buying it and the audience that it's finding.
Yeah.
What is the best way for you for people to get it? Or is it just wherever you can find it?
Well, wherever you can find it, for sure. So for right now, it is available on Amazon. And that's the best way for anyone to get it. It's going into stores, but I'm sure you've heard about this lovely sort of delay with everything. So books are very, very backed up right now. So getting the book into stores is going to be questionable for the next 2 months, mm-hmm. but it will definitely be in stores in the new year. But for now, up until January 1, it's on Amazon. So it's called The Big Snooze, A Duffer McDermott Mystery by Cornelius Peter. But yeah, Amazon's the best way for everyone to get it.
And we're going to wrap up here with it's usually a one question, but I feel like with what you've told me about the inspiration for the book, I'm going to give you two versions of the same question. And it works out well because you have is it the 13th hole, the island, or the island green?
Yeah, I'd have to go check myself, but I believe it's the 13th hole.
So I always ask when I have a musician on, I ask about an album or a writer, a book. For you, we're going to do both. If there was no land bridge to that 13th hole and you had to live on that island green for a year and you could only bring one mystery novel with you.
Okay.
To reread, what would you bring?
Oh, I think I'm going to cheat and say I would bring The Moonflower Murders by Anthony Horowitz. It is a fairly recent book and it's freaking awesome. I mean, if you're a mystery fan, you are going to love this book. It's Moonflower Murders, but I'm saying I'm cheating because it's two books in one. And so I would get, so what it is it's like a modern day, it's set in the modern day. There's an original murder mystery, but then within that book, there is another classic murder mystery set in the 1940s, stuffed right in the middle of the book. So that will keep you occupied. That would keep me occupied for quite a while. It's a real old school Agatha Christie, everybody's a suspect, you know, Hercule Poirot kind of mystery, which I absolutely love. So yeah, Moonflower Murders is the answer to that.
So if you guys are murder mystery fans, that one you should pick up after The Big Snooze, start with The Big Snooze and then go there.
The Big Snooze will take you a weekend and Moonflower Murders will take you a week.
And then the second question, since you are a self-proclaimed deadhead and dead factor into the book, you can go dead album or you can go dead live show on, you know, format of your choice. What do you bring to the island as well for musical entertainment?
Well, I would say any self-respecting deadhead was going to have to choose a live recording for sure. So I'm certainly going to go live recording on that. And I would say, I mean, the easy answer is Cornell 77, Barton Hall. I believe it's April 18th, 1977. See, this is where the deadheads are going to jump. This is where the deadheads are going to jump on me. I can't tell you.
This is where Grateful Ted would come in real handy. Grateful
Ted would be perfect. He would know all the songs in order. But I would say Cornell 77 or pretty much anything from 1977, 1978. There was a run of Boston shows that year. That's the hottest era. So anything from 77 or 78, probably 77 Cornell.
Great. I love it. Thank you. thank you so much for chatting. I hope everybody goes out and gets The Big Snooze and reads it. And where can everybody find you on the social media so that when they do read it and want to tell you how great it was and how fast they read it, they can send you their loving words.
Great. And let's make it a contest. Try to read it as fast as you can. It doesn't matter. There's no quiz. There's no quiz at the end. So just skim it and tell people you read it in one day. But it's my name. So I'm on Twitter at Cornelius Peter. And I'm also on TikTok. And this is really sad for an almost 50-year-old man, but I'm on TikTok and I give book recommendations every week on TikTok. So if you're a reader and you like books, you can find me at Cornelius Peter Author on TikTok. And I do little 1 minute just book recommendations, stuff that I'm reading right then. So find me there.
I love it. As a 42-year-old man who recently joined TikTok, I know exactly where you're coming from. I didn't want to do it. And then you'll enjoy this. I didn't want to do it. Then I got on there and, you know, you're putting up a stand-up clip here and there and whatever. But then I took my horrible sculled pitching wedge from the seventh hole at Pebble Beach that I had a video of. And I took a sound of somebody also playing golf that just saying, "I fucking suck." And I paired those together and I put it on there. A million views. People love to tell me, "You suck so much. You shouldn't be on that hole. How dare you? How dare you suck so bad at Pebble Beach?"
That's awesome, dude. Good for you. You really got a million views.
It was like 997 or something like that.
That's insane. Good for you. You cracked the code by just being shitty at golf. That's great. I haven't gotten that from my little book reviews yet, but hopefully
when the fans of the Joe Prano podcast find your
overrun
dozens even of new views. Well, thanks, dude. I really appreciate you coming on and we'll talk to you soon.
Yeah, this is a lot of fun. Thanks so much, Joe.
Hey, Joe, I like Joe's show. I tell everybody that's my shit. See, I had a long ride, turned the volume up high, and the time flew by so quick. I laughed out loud, that's what it's about, I really don't feel safe no more. And Joe stands out, even in a big crowd, cause he drinks till he hits the flow. Hey Joe, it's time to stop the show, pack it up and away we go. Donate cause we almost broke, everybody, that was Joe.